counsel go over our timekeeping mechanism when we have oral arguments by Zoom. And the cards will be in the upper left-hand corner, and they're all color-coded. So when it's time for you to start, you will see a green card saying start. Then when you have 5 minutes to go, there will be a yellow card saying 5 minutes. And when it's time to conclude the argument, there will be a stop card that's red. I'll help you keep track of the red card, but I will always permit you to answer a pending question from a justice. But after you answer that question, I likely will rein you in with the red card. Any questions at all before we begin? Okay, very good. Then I will call our first case, State versus Johnson. Attorney Barber, are you prepared to begin?
Yes.
Please do.
Good morning. All three issues before this court have a common thread running through them. The extent to which a jury should be allowed to excuse the homicide of an unarmed homeowner based upon an armed assailant's purported motivation for being in the house when the homeowner is shot 5 times and the defendant does not recall the details of the shooting. The Court of Appeals decision here made 3 significant errors of law that need to be reversed because they permit a jury to condone vigilantism. And Wisconsin law does not allow private citizens to play a game of to catch a criminal, but that's precisely the policy nightmare caused by the Court of Appeals decision. Before addressing the three issues, I do want to clarify one factual matter. There was some discussion in the response brief that perhaps Mr. Johnson had consent to enter. And no, there was a stipulation on the record, and that can be found at record 218, page 112 to 113. There was a stipulation that Mr. Johnson did not have consent to enter into KM's home. So with that clarification, I'd like to move to speak about the first issue in this case, about whether the jury was entitled or whether Mr. Johnson was entitled to a jury instruction on self-defense, on perfect self-defense. And as the state explains in its brief, he was not entitled to such an instruction for 2 separate and independent reasons. And the first issue has nothing to do with the Castle Doctrine. The first issue has to do with the fact that there was a complete and utter lack of evidence from which a jury could find that the amount of force used, 5 shots, was necessary and reasonable given the other evidence that was in the record. And as this court set forth in State versus Head and State versus Stites, in order to be entitled to an instruction on perfect self-defense, a defendant must cross an initial objective threshold of reasonableness. And if there is no evidence to cross that threshold, then the defendant is not entitled to an instruction on perfect self-defense. And contrary to what the Court of Appeals stated and contrary to what Mr. Johnson states, this case isn't about the circuit court weighing the evidence and taking that away from the jury. There is simply no evidence, 0 evidence, from which a jury could conclude that 5 shots was necessary and reasonable. Each shot.
Counsel, I want to just explore that for a minute. Let's isolate that point, the point you're raising here, and I just want to play it out. Obviously, there's an absence of memory in terms of what happened here. And is your conclusion, I mean, would it be the case that when somebody is attacked, they have a gun, they use it in self-defense, but they don't remember exactly what happened during the scuffle or when the gun came out or shooting, that element could not be met? I mean, so I get it that there's no direct testimony about it, but is it your position that no other circumstances or factors could support some evidence in this case that he was using proportionate force to defend himself?
Not in this case, Justice, and that's because, one, is we have 5 shots, including shots to the head and the back. 2, we have no other witnesses to the shooting. All we have is a testimony that there was a lunge. That's it. And that simply, objectively, shooting someone 5 times because they lunged at you is objectively unreasonable. Each shot
kind
is
of a gun
volitional
was it?
Act.
What kind of a gun was it? There are a variety of guns. If you have a revolver, you squeeze off each shot, or at least that's generally how they work. If you have some other kind of a gun, like a Glock or a gun that is put together in a different way, if you squeeze the trigger, it keeps shooting until you stop squeezing. What kind of gun was this?
This was a, I don't know the brand, but I believe it was a 40 millimeter. It was a semi-automatic. And I mean, I believe it was five separate pulls of the trigger. That I don't believe that there are fully automatic handguns where you just depress the trigger once and it keeps going. So he would still need to actuate the mechanism five times.
Okay. So, thank you. If we were to conclude that five shots is not not as important as you think it is, do you win? I mean, when you're taught in carrying concealed classes or, you know, taught to shoot guns, you are not necessarily told, shoot one bullet and see what happens, right? So it's not uncommon that multiple bullets in law enforcement situations, in other situations, whether it's civilian or law enforcement, that multiple bullets would be discharged out of a weapon if you're engaging in self-defense. So talk me through that a little bit. You reference the five bullets. You think that's a very important fact. I might think that's a less important fact. So help me out.
Well, I have a couple of responses to that, Justice. First of all, I mean, I think in both the law enforcement context and in just normal citizen self-defense, the amount of force used still has to be proportional. And there's always the inquiry of, you know, has the threat dissipated? And that's the problem here. Is we have no evidence that KM physically contacted Johnson, no evidence he made a threat to him, no evidence he picked up a weapon. And we have Johnson admitting that he did nothing short of shooting him. So based on those facts, no, there is not sufficient objective evidence to get to a jury.
Mr. Barber, what about the facts in the record about the prior violence that KM knew Johnson had engaged in? How does that factor into your analysis?
I don't think it factors. It does not independently cross that objective threshold. That informs what Johnson thought at the time. And that evidence came in. But regardless of the number of bad things that the victim allegedly did in the past, and these are years in the past, that standing in and of itself is not sufficient to justify five shots, including to the head and to the back. Because if that is sufficient, then the implication of that is that the jury can simply excuse someone from killing someone who's bad.
But you know, Deborah Head shot her husband repeatedly until he stopped coming toward her. So was hers okay? That homicide, was that entitled to more deference than we have here? Because she could say she kept shooting at him until he stopped coming toward her?
Thank you, Chief Justice Rogan. So a couple points on Head. First of all, the only issue that was at that case concerned solely imperfect self-defense.
And yes, I know that.
Very clear that it did not address perfect. But yes, I mean, the fact that in that case, she was able to testify that he reached for the gun, he made a contemporaneous threat, I'm gonna take care of you, and then she grabbed the gun and shot him until he stopped coming forward. We don't have any of that. We have no threat. We don't know if KM fell to the ground after the first shot. We don't know if he got back up. We simply do not know because Mr. Johnson claims not to remember it. And without there being any other witnesses, without there being objective evidence of a struggle, of wounds to Mr. Johnson, there is just no way to conclude that that's objectively reasonable. It's pure speculation.
Justice Rebecca Bradley, you go ahead first.
Go ahead. Isn't that a jury question, counsel? I mean, you're making a lot of assumptions and presumptions based on the evidence that is in the record. For example, you're arguing to us that it would be unreasonable for five shots to be made. You're suggesting that he intentionally shot KM in the head, that he intentionally shot KM in the back. Those are some pretty great leaps to make. And isn't the entire point of the Court of Appeals opinion that these are questions for the jury to resolve based on the evidence presented? And so long as Johnson presented some evidence to support the self-defense instruction, he is, as a matter of law, entitled to have the jury so instructed, right?
Well, the state's position is that there is not a reasonable basis in the evidence for a jury to find that the amount of force used was reasonable and necessary. There is a lack of any contemporaneous evidence from which this jury could find that. And so the state's position is that Johnson did not place perfect self-defense at issue because he failed to cross that objective reasonableness threshold.
Well, the Court of Appeals disagreed with that. The Circuit Court agreed with your position. But again, doesn't that disagreement, in fact, support the idea that the evidence, that the instruction should have been made to the jury? It doesn't mean that they're going to buy self-defense as a defense, but it's their determination to make. Isn't that what this case is all about?
I mean, the Court of Appeals said a lot of things I disagree with. The problem here is, again, this isn't about weighing the evidence. It's about there is nothing to justify the five shots. There's nothing. There's no threat. All the other things I went through. And you don't get to a jury simply by saying I was acting in self-defense. I understand some evidence is a low standard, but there still has to be something. And
it
here
is a
there
low
wasn't.
Standard here, and I don't think that you're taking into account the prior family relationship, of which there was quite a bit of evidence. In other words, we don't have a situation where this is a stranger intruding in the house and then shooting the homeowner five times. We have a family relationship here and a family history. And it was Johnson's defense, as I understand it, that he felt threatened by KM because of that history of abuse and violence that Johnson alleges KM committed against him. My question to you is, shouldn't we take that into account?
Well, I mean, that brings up an important point, because I think one of the fundamental errors that the Court of Appeals made is it confused the evidence of Johnson's motive for being there and his subjective fear with objective evidence of reasonableness of the proportionalness of the actual conduct of actually what happened. And the McMorris evidence came in and the state agreed that it was relevant to whether Johnson felt threatened. But that's not enough to get to a jury. There still has to be evidence from which a jury could reasonably conclude that he was in fact threatened. And there's not, because there's no evidence that KM said or did anything other than a lunge.
Isn't the some evidence, though, isn't that satisfied by Johnson's testimony that KM lunged at him or attacked him? Isn't that enough to satisfy that low threshold?
I don't believe that's enough to satisfy the objective reasonableness threshold, given the number of shots and the absence of any evidence of a struggle or contact.
Just to follow up on Justice Brandley's question, here we have KM sees Johnson in the open door. Then he shuts the door, right? And then barges through the door and attacks him, potentially, right, under Johnson's telling here. And this is his brother-in-law. This is not a random person, and Johnson testifies that Cam knew who it was. So you have someone with a history of violence who attacks you at 2 in the morning. What is a proportionate response to that? Are you saying that you couldn't use a gun in that situation if you're being physically attacked? I mean, five shots can be fired pretty fast, in the course of a struggle.
Well, first of all, the fact that Johnson testified that he thought KM knew who he was and why he was there, that is not evidence that KM actually knew that. That's simply Johnson's subjective belief. We don't know anything of what KM thought or did. because we don't know he did anything other than lunch.
The jury could believe that, right?
I don't believe a jury could conclude that based solely on Johnson's subjective belief. His testimony was, well, I looked at him and he knew why I was there. That's just speculation. That's his subjective belief. That's not objective evidence of any intent on the part of KM. And both the Court of Appeals and Johnson keep talking about, and this kind of transitions over to the other aspect of the self-defense thing here, keep talking about this as if the state is arguing that KM had a unfettered privilege to kill him. And that's not at all what we're talking about. What we're talking about is a homeowner lunging at an intruder. And whether the intruder at that point can have a reasonable belief that the homeowner is not able to do that. And I mean, I think a reasonable person, when they wake up in the middle of the night and they see someone standing in a dark room in their home at 2 a.m, I don't see how that the intruder could reasonably think that the homeowner doesn't have an ability to use some sort of force. We're not talking about, we have no evidence Cam was trying to kill him. That's the other thing that Johnson keeps saying. And there's no evidence of that. There's no verbal threat at the time. There's no verbal threat at any time within the, you know, they hadn't seen each other for a year. There's no verbal threat of, I'm going to kill you before then. So no, I do not think that under these facts, a jury could find that his conduct was objectively reasonable.
Attorney Barber, can you address the impact you think the Castle Doctrine has on this? Do we need to actually apply that in order to resolve this case?
My answer to that is no, and I do want to explain how that kind of became an issue here. The Castle Doctrine was talked about at the circuit court, but the Court of Appeals was wrong when it said that the circuit court based its jury instruction ruling on the Castle Doctrine. In fact, the circuit court kind of went out of its way to say that, look, regardless of how the Castle Doctrine impacts here, there's still not enough for that objective reasonable threshold. So it goes up on appeal. Johnson discusses it in his initial brief, and the state says in its response that it's not directly applicable. And then we've got the reason we're talking about it here is because we have this published Court of Appeals decision that kind of took it and made it the centerpiece of the decision. And the state's position with respect to the Castle Doctrine is that regardless of whether the view of the Jury Instruction Committee is correct or the view expressed in some of the drafting files is correct, even under a narrow interpretation, what the Court of Appeals, the reason why it erred is because it said, unless we're going to put KM on trial and we're going to suppose he's on trial here, and unless he checks all the boxes for this Castle Doctrine presumption, if he doesn't, that means, ergo, that Johnson could reasonably believe that KM didn't have a right to interfere with him. And that's just not correct. Regardless of how this would have played out if KM had lived, regardless of whether he would have been able to argue a Castle Doctrine presumption to the jury, the state's position is simply that it is not objectively reasonable for an armed intruder to enter someone's home and to think that the homeowner doesn't have the ability to exercise some degree of force. So regardless of whether the Castle Doctrine provides complete immunity or is just satisfies a burden of production, it's not, they're not two sides of the same coin. It's not that if the presumption doesn't apply, therefore the belief was reasonable. That's not how this works.
Counsel, yes. If the court were to determine that there was error regarding the instruction, would the court then undergo a harmless error analysis? And do you think this was harmless if people on the court would believe that there was indeed error?
Well, I mean, the state did not argue harmless error in the briefs before this court. On that point, I will note that when we're talking about what instruction was given and what wasn't, the jury was instructed on self-defense. They were simply not given that first bullet point in 1016 saying that that self-defense is a complete defense to all forms of homicide. That's kind of the only substantive thing that was left off here. So I don't think the court made an error of law in not instructing on this. And the issue, if the court's going to get to whether it's harmless, and I think that's tied up in some of the other issues here as well with the evidence. But I mean, the state's position is simply that he was not entitled to this instruction, regardless of how the Castle Doctrine pans out.
Have you forfeited the argument that there's harmless error here then by not arguing it before us?
I mean, it was not argued in the state's briefs to this court. I believe it was argued in the Court of Appeals briefs, and whether there was forfeiture, that's, I mean, there are a number of decisions where this court has held that, you know, forfeiture doesn't apply, or it's going to look past a forfeiture. So I think that's really up to the court to determine.
Counsel, you advance in your argument that this weapon required discrete pulls of the trigger, five active pulls of the trigger. Is that in the record?
I don't think it's in the record, and I it's possible I'm wrong, but I do not believe that there's any handgun where you depress the trigger once and it keeps expending ammunition. There were 11 rounds in the magazine, five were discharged.
You're correct, counsel.
Our arms expert.
I'd like to move on to the second issue now, the issue about the second degree reckless instruction. And I think this issue is just a lot easier than the first issue. Because the undisputed facts are we have five shots being discharged in close quarters with someone who is not armed. And the law presumes that someone intends the natural and probable consequences of their actions. And there's no way a jury could conclude that Johnson showed any regard for the life of KM. And so there is this threshold legal issue here about whether his purported concern for his niece, who lived 3.5 hours away, whether that can meet the standard. And the state's position is it can't. We have the case of Miller. Miller involved third parties who were actually present, who were actually being assaulted, who were in imminent danger. I mean, they were being assaulted. And there was a defense of others. There was no instruction on defense of others in this case. There was no third party.
Assume for the moment, for the purposes of my question, that this court agrees with the Court of Appeals under that perfect self-defense should have been instructed, including the element that a jury could conclude that he only used the force he believed necessary under the circumstances. How does that change this question regarding the instruction on the second degree homicide, reckless homicide?
I don't know if it does, because if we're looking at second degree, we're necessarily assuming the jury didn't convict on the others. And so the question is simply, was there evidence that the jury conclude he didn't act with other disregard? And that's an objective standard, and that simply cannot be satisfied based upon the facts and the record here.
Is bringing a gun into your brother-in-law's house while trespassing at night, does that satisfy this in your view or not?
The state's bottom line position on this is you have two people in an enclosed room. I think it was like 10 by 10 or 10 by 6 or something. And Johnson shot five times at KM. That in and of itself evidences utter disregard. And there's no way a jury could find he didn't have utter disregard for KM's life. You know,
wait a minute. Let me just back up, counsel. Maybe I didn't quite flesh out the answer I was looking for here. Assume for the moment that a jury can conclude that only the force that only the force was used that was reasonably necessary. Does that undercut your argument regarding the second issue? You're saying that shooting five shots in close range is inherently utter disregard for human life, but if we conclude a jury could conclude, there's at least some evidence here that only the force that was reasonably necessary was used, that a jury could find that based on the facts. Does that compel you also losing on the second question?
I think there are two separate questions. There's the issue of the intent when pulling the trigger, and then there's the issue of whether it was justified. So I don't necessarily think one controls the other, because again, if the jury's looking at second degree reckless, they've already gone through and rejected the other charges.
I think what Justice Hagedorn is asking, and Justice Hagedorn, I know you'll, if I don't catch this, I know you will correct me, but I think the question is this: can someone act in self-defense, the perfect self-defense that we're talking about, and also act in utter disregard for human life? I see Justice Hagedorn nodding his head.
That's a helpful way to end. Thank you, Justice.
I would have tried to come up with some hypothetical, but I couldn't think of one on the fly.
I believe...
May he answer this question, Chief Justice Robinson?
Of course.
Thank you.
I believe the jury instruction for recklessness does indicate that in evaluating whether the conduct was reckless, that the reasonableness plays into that. So I'm not sure your question that if there was an entitlement to an instruction on perfect self-defense, that necessarily means he gets the second degree reckless as well. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Attorney White, are you prepared to begin?
Yes, Your Honor, thank you.
Please do.
Catherine White for the defendant appellant, Alan Johnson. May it please the court. This court must draw all reasonable inferences from the evidence in Johnson's favor. That's what's required at this point. And the evidence shows that Johnson's whole family was afraid of KM. For decades, Johnson and his sisters had been the victims of KM's repeated physical and sexual assaults. Johnson had never been able to defend himself against KM. Instead, he avoided KM. But when Johnson discovered KM's stash of child pornography, pictures of little girls the same age as his niece, he took a risk. He snuck into KM's home one night while everyone was asleep to gather the evidence that the cops needed to arrest KM. He was afraid.
Counsel, what if what he found on the computer was not child pornography? I don't think the record really tells us whether it was or whether it wasn't. So what if it was not child pornography? Does that make a difference to your argument?
Ultimately, the question is not whether the pictures that he saw were actually child pornography. The question is whether it was reasonable for him to believe that they were child pornography, and reasonable for KM to believe that they were child pornography, that is, illegal materials that he was harboring in his home.
We would never know what KM thought. How do we get to look at that?
The question is whether Johnson's belief that KM was attacking him to prevent him from delivering this evidence to the law enforcement is reasonable. So it goes to self-defense. It also goes to Johnson's motivation for coming to the home in the first place, his reasonable belief or the reasonableness of his belief that KM was attacking him for an improper purpose. And ultimately, it goes to Johnson's credibility as well. Johnson testified that he found child pornography on KM's computer years prior. He was unable to present evidence because of the court's evidentiary ruling that similar photos were located on KM's computer. And the state, in closing, argued to the jury that Johnson shouldn't be believed because he had not submitted proof that he had actually found child pornography years prior.
Counsel?
Yes.
Does your argument invite sort of a new brand of vigilante justice? If I think somebody else has something in their house that I wish law enforcement could get through proper means, like a warrant or their own investigation, and I break into their house and decide to go through their personal things, including their computer, in search of that which law enforcement cannot lawfully get, I then have a new protection under your argument that I wouldn't have had before if I shoot the homeowner repeatedly. Have you thought about those implications of your argument?
Absolutely. I think that's a very reasonable argument to make to the jury, and one that the jury could believe. But the question here isn't whether the evidence is insufficient. The question is whether the jury should have been instructed properly on the law concerning self-defense. The state is welcome to make those arguments, and they should properly be considered by the jury under the provocation instruction.
But doesn't that argument kind of stand the Castle Doctrine on its head a little bit? I mean, the castle owner here is the victim of the shooting, because the shooter is the person that doesn't belong there in the victim's house on the victim's computer, searching for evidence that law enforcement said previously we can't lawfully obtain.
I believe what the law enforcement told to Alan Johnson was, what the evidence you've given us isn't enough, but if you find more, let us know. Now, whether Johnson, it was a good idea for Johnson to go on his own to locate the evidence that the cops said they needed, that's certainly something for the jury to discuss. But ultimately, the question here is whether a jury might reasonably conclude that at the point at which KM opened the door, saw Johnson, closed the door, then silence for an undetermined amount of time. KM didn't call the cops. KM didn't call out to his wife. Instead, he threw the door back open and he attacked Johnson. At that point, was it reasonable for Johnson to believe that KM, who had assaulted him for decades, was about to attack him and attempt to kill him?
That's what Johnson believed. It was KM's home, right? And yes. Johnson, you agree, had no right to be in KM's home, right?
I think the jury could reasonably conclude that Johnson was trespassing at that point, and that's certainly something that they can consider when considering the totality of the evidence. They can also consider the fact that the door was unlocked, Johnson didn't force his way inside. Johnson had previously lived in that home. It was his sister's home and his nephew's home, and he'd been there quite often. These are all things for the jury to consider, and the jury might well disagree with me ultimately. That's fine. But there's sufficient evidence, some evidence, which we all agree is a very low bar, that would allow this question to be one for the jury properly to consider, not for this court. At this point, we all have to consider the evidence and draw all reasonable inferences from the evidence in Johnson's favor. And the question really is focused on whether a reasonable jury could conclude that Johnson's belief that KM was about to kill him was reasonable. KM is someone who had previously punched Johnson for no reason, completely out of the blue, had on a near daily basis wrestled with Johnson, sexually assaulted him when he was a child. KM had strangled Johnson's sister to the point that she blacked out. And these were incidents that occurred when there was no reason for KM to attack these children. Now KM had a very good reason to attack.
So in any home invasion situation, make sure you bring your gun, because if the homeowner comes upon you in the home, you can say that you thought you had a good reason to be there, and so you shot the homeowner under your analysis, or at least it gets to a jury. Is that a reasonable interpretation of the law?
I disagree. The mere fact that Johnson testified as to the reason for his being in the house doesn't allow for the self-defense instruction. It's the totality of the circumstances, Johnson's history with KM, the action of KM coming into the room, opening the door once, seeing Johnson, closing the door, and then reopening it and immediately lunging at and attacking Johnson. Those totality of the circumstances are what allow for a self-defense instruction in this case specifically. Were we to turn the tables, were we looking at KM being on the stand here, the one facing trial, it might very well be that a self-defense instruction might be appropriate if he were the one claiming, I was afraid for my life, I thought he was going to kill me, and so I used force instead. I'm not saying that KM couldn't have that argument were he the one on the stand, but right now, Johnson is the one facing trial, and the question is whether Johnson's beliefs were reasonable, not...
Counsel, I'm sorry. Are you finished with your answer?
I am. Go ahead.
I'm concerned on the second part of that inquiry, and that being whether under 93948, there is evidence to indicate to support a reasonable belief that only the force necessary to terminate the interference was used. As your opposing counsel advances, five shots, head back, what evidence is there? Some evidence is there to meet that burden.
When it comes to the number of shots fired and whether the amount of force that was used was reasonable under the circumstances, that's a question for the jury. Five shots might be considered reasonable. Perhaps the jury decides that it's not reasonable. To me, when I hear five shots, I think panic. This isn't a calculated murder. This is somebody pulling the trigger in panic. And as several of you pointed out earlier, that's not unreasonable. When it comes to the average person, you're not taught to just pull the trigger once and wait to see what happens. This is a man with a history of repeatedly victimizing Johnson, rushing at him in a small room. Johnson pulls the trigger. He pulls it multiple times. There are multiple shots fired. That's a question for the jury.
Counsel,
Justice Bradley, please.
Thank you. You paint the picture of panic. How does that interface with the statutory language requiring intentionality? The actor may intentionally use only such force. Panic seems devoid of intention.
As I understand it, one can pull a trigger intentionally and yet still with a feeling or emotion of panic. So I don't believe that the two are at odds with each other. I would also stress that Johnson's testimony was not simply that KM lunged at him. Johnson testified that KM attacked him. Johnson was the only person in the room at that time. The jury was free to either believe or disbelieve his testimony. But we know from the verdict that the jury believed him, because Johnson also testified that he didn't go to the house with the intention of killing KM, and the jury acquitted him of burglary and intentional homicide. So we know that Johnson's testimony was believable to a reasonable jury. And again, at this point, even if it weren't for those acquittals, the court still has the obligation to view all of the evidence in Johnson's favor.
Counsel, how is going armed with a firearm not utter disregard for human life?
The mere fact that somebody carries a gun doesn't mean that they disregard human life.
Well, I meant, I guess I is not asked very well on my part. The fact that he actually used the firearm, not just going armed with it, but the fact that he discharged, that the activity that we're talking about here is the discharge of a firearm at someone. How is discharge of a firearm ever not utter disregard when it's pointed at someone?
Well, this court and the Court of Appeals have previously held that there was insufficient evidence of the utter disregard element when the defendant shot someone else. For example, in State versus Miller, the Court of Appeals held that the evidence was insufficient insufficient to support the utter disregard element, despite the fact that the defendant shot someone. So the mere act of shooting someone does not necessarily evince an utter disregard for human life. Out of state, in other jurisdictions, courts have found that the self-defense claim can go hand in hand with utter disregard. And so, for example, in Florida, there's a line of cases that I discovered. You can find them in Antoine versus State at 138 Southern 3rd, 1064. Those discuss this impulsive overreaction doctrine, which indicates that a defendant's use of force may be excessive so as to be insufficient to amount to self-defense, perfect self-defense, but still doesn't evince a depraved mind, which is Florida's wording for our utter disregard element. And so the two go hand in hand, which is why I do believe if the court agrees with us that perfect self-defense should have been instructed to the jury, utter disregard, the second degree reckless homicide also should have been instructed to the jury. Ultimately, utter disregard is, it's really about the community, and it's a question of reasonableness that is usually for the jury to decide. It's not a black and white concept. You have to consider the totality of the circumstances. And under the circumstances here, we can consider Johnson's professed belief that he was afraid for his life and he was acting to defend himself and to protect his own life. Even if the jury doesn't agree with us that that belief was reasonable, it may still be enough for the jury to decide that he was not acting in utter disregard of human life.
Did he testify, in fact, that he was afraid for his life? Is there testimony in the record?
Yes, he testified not only that at that time he was afraid for his life, but that going into it, that's why he brought the gun in the first place, because he was afraid that if he was found out, despite his best efforts to get in and out undetected, if he was discovered, he was afraid that KM was going to attack him and kill him. He knew that KM would know why he was there, and he was afraid that KM would be so enraged and so motivated to prevent him from going to law enforcement that KM would attack him as KM had done for decades.
Did KM have a privilege to attack him at the moment he attacked him?
I don't know from this record. My understanding of the self-defense of the Castle Doctrine statute is that it requires the actor, KM, to claim that he acted in self-defense, to claim that he actually believed that he was going to be attacked, going to be hurt, and that he acted as a result to protect his own life. Here, we don't have KM's testimony.
But if you have someone who's in your house in the middle of the night, do you really have to have the Castle Doctrine to attack them so that you can overpower them, call the police, or whatever you're going to do with them?
That's true. Even without the Castle Doctrine, someone could claim self-defense in a situation such as that.
Well, I was not looking at self-defense. I was looking, because this is an unlawful interference, is where your argument starts. And my question goes more to whether the interference was unlawful. did K.M. have a right to attack this person who was in his room, in his house, in the middle of the night? If he did, then how is his interference with Johnson unlawful?
So K.M. may have been able to claim the privilege of self-defense if
I'm not looking at self-defense for K.M. I'm looking at the right to attack Johnson in the first instance. That's where I'm stopping right there. Not self-defense. Didn't he have the privilege to attack him? He's in his home in the middle of the night without his permission, and there's a stipulation. There was no consent for him to be there.
I confess I have not seen that stipulation, and so I will look at it when oral argument is done to confirm that it is there in the record. To my knowledge, the mere fact that someone is in your home does not give you the right to attack them.
Really?
Yes.
In the middle of the night? Three small kids sleeping in the bed, and your husband hears some noise, comes out, and there's somebody in your house? He doesn't have a right to attack that person in his own house?
Certainly the circumstances may amount to circumstances that would allow for that privilege. But the mere fact that someone is in your home is insufficient.
What bothers me is that part of your argument requires that KM was unlawfully interfering with Johnson. But if KM had the right to attack someone who was in his house in the middle of the night without permission, how do you show unlawful interference? That's what's kind of bugging me.
So ultimately, again, the question is one for the jury, and the state can make the argument that KM was unlawfully interfering. However, the evidence indicates, when viewed in Johnson's favor, that KM knew Johnson, knew this wasn't a burglar, some random invader in his home. He knew it was his nephew. He had a long history of overpowering his nephew.
There's nothing in the record that shows he knew who was in the room. There's nothing that shows us what KM knew or didn't know, right? That's all supposition.
I disagree.
What's in the record that shows that KM knew it was Johnson in the room?
Johnson testified that he was in the room. He saw KM, could see clearly enough to see that it was in fact KM, and that KM could see him. Ultimately here, the question is not whether KM actually, what KM's actual thoughts or motivations were. The question is what Johnson believed and whether his belief was reasonable. And so,
right. But here's the problem. In any burglary situation, it's not always, when someone's trespassing into your home, it's not always a stranger that does the trespassing, merely because you know who someone is or may have had history with that person, in no way endows them with the authority to come into your home and go through your belongings. It just doesn't. So how do you get there? All of a sudden you have put Johnson in the place of someone who may lawfully and correctly belong there, imparting certain rights and defenses to the person who had zero business being in the other person's home. No business being in that person's home. That person is presumably surprised, comes downstairs. Think about this from anyone's perspective. You come upon someone, whether you know them or not, who should not be in your home and should not be going through your belongings. Now, all of a sudden, you're the bad guy because that person is in your house going through your things without any permission?
That's absolutely an argument that the state can make to the jury, and the jury might buy it, they might not. The jury can consider those factors under the provocation instruction, and they can consider absolutely why Johnson went there in the first place, whether it was a good idea for him to go into KM's house in the middle of the night. And they can consider the fact that Johnson was trapped in a small room with KM, who had abused him sexually and physically since he was a small child.
Ms. White, when was the last time in the record, that is, in looking at the date of the offense, what was the most recent time that Johnson was a victim of KM?
So Johnson, as well as his sisters, testified that KM would assault them pretty much any chance he got. And so Johnson cut off contact with KM after seeing the child pornography. And so the attacks stopped at that point simply because KM couldn't attack him because he wasn't around.
And how many days, months, years was that before this incident where KM was killed?
So Johnson testified that it was sometime around perhaps 2009. I don't think he testified as to a precise date or even year, but as far as I can tell from the record, it was probably around 2009 that he discovered the child pornography on KM's computer, reported it to NCMEC, reported it to his father.
And remind me, when was the date of this assault?
This was October 24th, 2016, October 25th, early in the morning of October 25th.
So it's a 7-year, it was 7 years had passed between the last time Johnson had threatened, excuse me, KM had threatened Johnson, according to Johnson's testimony. Do I have that right?
Approximately. Again, we know that the date of the incident, but the date on which he discovered the child pornography and exactly how long after that he last saw KM, the dates aren't precise in the record. But yeah, I would say perhaps 5 years or so. It's unclear exactly. But again, it's not that KM stopped assaulting Johnson. It's that Johnson stayed away and avoided KM in order to get the assaults to stop, because historically he had never been able to defend himself against KM. KM had overpowered him since he was a young child.
Counsel, I want to get to this last issue, which we haven't really touched on at all. You advocate that the evidence of what was found on the computer, that we ought to review that de novo under this theory of a constitutional right to present a defense. I'm a little concerned that your argument turns ordinary evidentiary questions into constitutional questions. We have a very long, long body of law that says that these sorts of things are ordinarily reviewed under erroneous exercise of discretion. And we would give a trial court pretty broad authority to determine that the evidence here is more prejudicial, than probative, which is obviously what the trial court found here. So I'd like you to talk about that a little bit, and particularly what makes this particularly unique, or how we're not heading down a slippery slope of second guessing every evidentiary question as a constitutional question rather than an ordinary evidentiary question that admittedly impacts the fairness of trials, but that trial courts are empowered to do every day.
Certainly. So this court held, and most recently, I believe, in State versus Wilson, that these evidentiary questions, when it comes to the exclusion of evidence offered by the defense, should be reviewed de novo when it implicates the defendant's constitutional right to present a defense. But to be clear, even if you operate under the more lenient standard of review, looking simply for an erroneous exercise of discretion, we still win. The evidence.
Put aside the specific. I appreciate that argument, but I actually really want you to address this. Why does this fall under a constitutional right to present a defense? Why isn't this an ordinary evidentiary question up to the trial court's discretion?
Sure. Thank you. So this is not a small piece of evidence. This goes directly to the defendant's credibility, as evidenced by the state's argument in closing to the jury that the defendant shouldn't be believed because he testified that there was child pornography, but he never provided any proof of that. Ultimately, it also goes directly to the self-defense question and whether his beliefs were reasonable, whether he actually believed that KM was attacking him because he found this evidence, and whether his actual belief was reasonable.
I get that it's helpful. I understand all of that. I understand why you'd want that information in, why it's helpful to his defense. But at what point does that turn that into a constitutional question? And trial courts make those decisions all the time for these sorts of issues, ways that are more helpful or less helpful. And again, when do we cross the threshold of this is now a constitutional question, and now appellate courts need to review this de novo?
Yeah, I agree there's not a clear, bright line, so I don't have an on-off switch to give to you. I do think that the fact that the defendant is the proponent of the evidence, is asking for the evidence to be admitted, that certainly goes to the constitutional issue, right? Because it's the defendant's right to present a defense. The fact that that this is not some side evidence, but that it's really important to two of the main, well, to his credibility, which goes throughout the defense, but also to two of his main claims, to imperfect self-defense and perfect self-defense.
Counsel, wasn't there a constitutional problem with the fact, as you state in your briefing, that in rebuttal, the state told the jury that it shouldn't believe Johnson because he did not produce the pornographic images that he claimed to have found in the computer that night? And of course, as that was the state's rebuttal, the defense had no opportunity to respond.
Absolutely. I definitely agree with you there. So I think there are a number of reasons why this evidence goes to Johnson's constitutional right to present a defense. He was unable to exercise that right fully because the court did not allow him to present the evidence, in part because the prosecution agreed not to question his credibility on the child pornography, not to raise the question of whether there actually was child pornography on the computer. And the prosecution did not live up to its promise, and again, didn't live up to it in rebuttal, so that Johnson had no ability to respond. So I don't know that this case necessarily presents the court with the opportunity to lay out a bright line rule as to when the exclusion of evidence should be reviewed de novo, but certainly in this case, it should be. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. Attorney Barber, are you prepared for rebuttal?
Yes, and I want to start by, I need to address this issue of the closing argument because it's simply not true. Page 186 here, I don't have the, what is it, I think, is it 220 or 222 maybe, the transcript of the closing argument. The state is talking about, the state simply says, we don't know what the initial picture was that Johnson saw 5 years ago. And the quote is, that hasn't been introduced in the evidence. The defendant said he couldn't find it again when he went back. So the state is simply saying Johnson, and he did testify to this, did not find the initial picture that he saw 5 years ago. And the court allowed that portion of the comment in, that is what Johnson testified to. So there's no improper argument here. And even if there was, I don't believe it was raised in the Court of Appeals on this. So this is taking a small, you know, snippet of the closing argument that's talking about what was found in the computer 5 years ago. The state did not say, you can't believe Johnson because he never produced evidence of child pornography on that date in question. That argument was not made. So I just want to be clear on that. Secondly, the state's position is that it doesn't matter one bit whether it was child pornography, adult pornography, pirated movies on his computer. That does not inform, that doesn't say anything about whether the amount of force used was reasonable or whether KM had a right to interfere with the armed intruder in his home at 2 a.m.
I would like you to address that latter point because it is what it has developed for me to be a major concern. KM has to prove, excuse me, Johnson has to prove that he was stopping or preventing an unlawful interference with him, correct?
Correct.
Okay, so I don't think the arguments have focused a whole lot on maybe how that, what kind of evidence was there in the record that showed that KM was acting unlawfully in his own home?
I have a couple of responses to that because, I mean, the Court of Appeals tied that up with the Castle Doctrine and then engaged in this speculation that, well, the jury could think that KM was trying to stop Johnson from getting these photos that might be on his computer. And again, there's no evidence of that. But the state's position on this, I just want to be clear because of all the different arguments that came out in the briefs here. The state's position is simply that, and this ties in directly with your question about KM's ability to use force, is that an armed intruder cannot reasonably think that a homeowner lacks the ability to use some amount of force on the person. That belief, coming into the house with an armed gun, that you don't get to a jury because it's just objectively unreasonable to think that the homeowner can't do something. And we're not talking about killing Johnson. Right. We're just talking about did he have the privilege to do something? And the state submits, in this case, yes, he had the privilege to do something. We don't get to the consequences because he's dead. So we don't.
What if I went to my mom's house?
It depends on whether you live there, doesn't it, Brian? I mean, you don't live with your mom. I happen to know that, but
I don't live with my mother. But what if I went to my mom's house? My mom wakes up. She sees me at 2 a.m. Reasonable thing that my mom can't attack me.
So this is part of the trouble.
They'd probably give you a piece of a pie, Brian.
That's probably right.
I don't know if my mother saw me in her house at 2 in the morning, she might. But this is an important point, jokes aside, that the whether the homeowner has the legal right to use force against an intruder cannot be dependent upon the reason why the intruder is there. This notion that, well, it matters if he was there to find pornography or not, the state just fundamentally disagrees with that, because that basically means that a homeowner has to ask an intruder, well, are you here for the stash of porn you think's on my computer, or are you here for my wife's jewelry? Because if it's my jewelry, then I'm going to push out, but if it's for the computer, then, you know, be my guest, come right in. That's not how this works. You don't get to invade someone's house while armed and then say, well, the jury should be allowed to claim that I was justified because this guy was a really bad person. And that's what their argument boils down to, is that he was a bad guy, he did bad things, therefore I shot him 5 times and the jury should be allowed to excuse that. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much. Thank you very much for a very, very interesting case. It presents a lot of good issues for us to review, and your briefs were very helpful, as were your oral arguments. We are now going to adjourn this case and take a little break while we get set up for our second case of the morning. We are adjourned.